organization OIA today. We welcome you and thank you for coming, responding to our call. We are going to begin with the business of the day, and the meeting is declared open. We have people from various organizations, but what the people will be giving us presentation today is National Employers Association of South Africa. We have the Chief Executive Officer present. We have Santago. We also have the President present today. We also have the Free Market Foundation. Those are the people who will be starting the presentation today. There is Mr. Longshot. He is an economist in that organization. Other people we usually invite trade unions to be part, and then those who are from business, but our major focus is on trade unions at this stage. Compulsory that they must be part of this. As we speak, they will introduce themselves, because I don't want to call the names that have confirmed, and only to find out I'm calling a name of someone who's not here. So during our deliberations, people will then just tell us where they come from, where they are, and that will be in order. Thank you so much. Mr. Lone, I'm sure you are ready. It's over to you.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I apologize, but I just wanted to make two apologies for people that aren't here today, if I may do so. Is that in order?
That is in order. We have received, I have received the apology from Mr. Ollis.
And Mr. Derek America.
Then America communicated with the committee. Forgive me for not recording that.
Okay.
It's in order. Thank you so much. Mr. Long.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for giving me the opportunity today to tell you a bit about the Free Market Foundation and some of the issues that this committee will wrestle with over the next year or so in considering and contemplating a national minimum wage. I don't have an official presentation. I'm not going to speak for very long. But what I have done is brought a booklet from the Free Market Foundation called Jobs, Jobs, Jobs. And this book has nearly 20 chapters of different issues covering or affecting the labor market in South Africa. So we look at unionization, we look at minimum wages, and I encourage you to read the book. It's critical, I think, especially for new members of this portfolio, new members of the House, to get a different perspective on what might be needed to create jobs on the scale that we need to in South Africa. So I don't have a formal PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to tell you first a little bit about the Free Market Foundation and what our philosophy is. I'm then going to take you on a little trip down memory lane of South Africa's labor market over the last 120 years. And then I'm going to conclude with our perspective on the national minimum wage. And I also want to give you certain pointers, certain things that you can look out for as you conduct hearings, as you consider the national minimum wage. And I'm not going to bore you to tears, I'm not going to talk for nearly an hour, but let me tackle this very important issue in those three ways. So the first question is, What does the Free Market Foundation stand for? And the short answer is that we stand for political and economic freedom. So it's a great privilege for me to be in this house, in the same chamber where Dr. Verwoerd was attacked during his service as Prime Minister. It's humbling to be in this place, which is the center of democracy in South Africa. The Free Market Foundation has a long history in the anti-apartheid movement, and we experience many of the same issues that democratic movements experienced in South Africa during the 70s and 80s. So the Free Market Foundation deals with or has a philosophy around political and economic freedom. And as I say, it's very humbling to be here in the circumstances of a democratic South Africa. One of the things that is challenging to us at the foundation is that even though South Africa has political freedom, democracy has come to South Africa, our concern in the country at the moment is that political freedom has not translated into economic freedom. Economic freedom remains elusive for many of the members of our society, even though political freedom has arrived. And 20 years after democracy, we need to consider how much economic freedom there is in the country. But that's our philosophy at the Free Market Foundation, political and economic freedom. Now, I want to take you on a little tour of history, just for a few minutes, telling you how the foundation views the labor market in South Africa over the last 120 years. And if you'll bear with me, I just want to tell a little story. In 1886, gold was discovered on the Witwatersrand. And it was such an exciting discovery that tens of thousands of Europeans from Europe, Danish, Swedish, Dutch, German, Finnish, and many others, tens of thousands of Europeans flocked to South Africa in an attempt to make their fortunes. It soon became clear, after the discovery of gold on the Witwatersrand, it soon became clear that an enormous amount of capital was needed to develop the mines. And as a result, some individuals sponsored by capitalists in Britain and the United States, they came to South Africa and started buying up all the small claims that these European prospectors had on the Witwatersrand. And very soon, the wealth, the mineral wealth on the Witwatersrand concentrated in the hands of a very small group of people. The workers who had been prospectors before, these mainly white miners at the time, they became employees rather than owners of this mining industry. And right from the beginning, the trade union movement was active in the promotion of workers' rights on the Witwatersrand. So during this period, as these European mine workers moved to South Africa, they brought with them the principles of unionization. And by 1904, 80% of the white mine workers on the Witwatersrand had unionized. And these unions were very aggressive, but they represented only white mine workers. And what was interesting about this time is that the white mine workers ended up with significant power over the mine owners. And where this became problematic was that these white mine workers became extremely militant and extremely difficult, with the result that in 1922, the white mine workers occupied the towns of Boksburg, Benoni, and Springs. They occupied these towns, they captured the town halls in each of these towns, they were extremely violent, with the result that Prime Minister Smuts, at the time in 1922, sent the military in to recapture these towns on the Witwatersrand from the white mine workers. In one particular day, which we now call the Rand Rebellion, over 200 white mine workers were killed and over 2,000 white mine workers were hospitalized based on the military tactics of Prime Minister Smuts. That event, the Rand Rebellion, led white mine workers and their trade unions to distance themselves from Prime Minister Smuts's government, and in the process they swept the nationalists to government, they swept the nationalists to power. It was an extraordinary time and reflected the extraordinary power that white mine workers had in the political system of the day. I feel as if, when I look at this history, we're going through a similar process in South Africa today. Marikana is the Rand Rebellion of today. And the question is, how do we respond to these events as government, as businesses, as workers' unions, as people interested in economic and political freedom? Marikana, as I say, is the modern day Rand Rebellion. And what's extraordinary to me is that the events in the labor market over the last 3 to 4 years are going to set in motion an extraordinary political process over the next 20 to 30 years. And we're starting to see the effects of that process already. We've seen it in unions called to ban labor brokers. We've seen it in government's call to introduce a national minimum wage. We've seen a whole range of activities designed to establish workers' rights over the last few years. And the question that arises for me is, over the next 20 to 30 years, what is going to be the cumulative effects of these incursions into economic freedom? What is going to be the net result of infringements on economic freedom? Well, I just want to take you through a couple of case studies. The first case study is the agricultural sector in South Africa. When the new government took power in 1994, one of the first things the new government did was to reverse the privileges of white farm owners. But I think what was unanticipated at the time, it seemed right. These farm owners, mostly white, were receiving government subsidies to operate these farms. And the white farm owners lived in a situation of extreme affluence. So you can understand that at that time, just after democracy, white farm owners lost their political influence. And as a result, they lost their subsidies, their so-called marketing subsidies, but nonetheless subsidies for operating agriculture. There was an extraordinary unintended consequence. Between 1996 and 2014, employment in agriculture fell from 2.1 million to 770,000. So the agricultural sector today employs less than a third of the people it did 20 years ago. And really, that's what I want to encourage you to look at as South Africa goes through this process of examining the worth and the value of a minimum wage, a national minimum wage. The point for me is not so much what the intentions of government are. We know that government has very good intentions in introducing a national minimum wage. And the intentions include raising the living standards of the most vulnerable workers. But what I want to urge you today, if I can urge you just one thing, is as this debate around the national minimum wage unfolds over the next year and possibly 2 years, I want you to evaluate the minimum wage not based on government's intentions, which are good. I want you to evaluate the national minimum wage based on the consequences, the unintended consequences. So if I can just speak to you, just before I conclude my talk, I want to speak to you about what are likely to be the consequences of a national minimum wage. The first consequence is that employers who cannot afford to pay workers the minimum wage will lay them off in the short term, but in the long term, much more importantly, they will fail to hire new workers who have less productivity than the national minimum wage. So let's say, for example, an employer is forced to pay a 4,500 rand a month minimum wage. And let's say that workers' production is only worth 2,500 per month. What will happen is that worker will not have his wage increased to 4,500 rand because his production is only worth 2,500 rand. That worker will be laid off. It might not happen immediately, but over a period of 10 to 20 years, that change is inevitable. As I said, agriculture is a classic example. It's been totally destructive to the farms in the Western Cape. It's been totally destructive to the farms in KwaZulu-Natal. A worker whose productivity does not justify the national minimum wage will be laid off, or worse, never hired in the first place. As I say, agriculture is a stunning example of how employment over a 20-year period dropped from 2.1 million to just over 700,000. So what I'd like to urge you is to read the book on jobs that Zolani will distribute to members, honourable members. And what I'd like you to do is bear in mind not what the intentions are, which are good, behind a national minimum wage. I want you to bear in mind what the consequences, and especially the unintended consequences, will be. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Shah. There is the input. It's a short but brief to the point, detailed. We appreciate that. We will give, I will give over to the members. So the House members and the guests are to the House to engage on the presentation by Mr. Sharp. I see the first hand is Mr. Barclay. This side. Your name, sir? Vuyo from? The second one will be Vuyo from Nomsa. Let's take those two. I've noted you, member. Mr. Patrick. Honourable Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Mr. Schott, thank you ever so much for the input. We really appreciate it. Obviously, as the committee gets further and further and delves further into the minimum wage, we're going to be relying on statistics and studies that are done. And for every study that is done to say how the minimum wage uplifts the people, there's going to be another study to show how it destroys jobs. I know I've been going through it now for the past 2 months, and I'm picking up studies all over the world, and a lot of them contradict each other. I presume the reason why you looked at agriculture in South Africa is because that study is pertinent to us here in South Africa. In particular, I know it's also current. Jobs are being lost at the moment. But there are those that are going to tell us that the reason why jobs are being lost is not because of the increase in the minimum wage. I think it was increased by 40%. But because of agriculture and because of other factors. I presume you would take that into account when you do your studies. So if you could just give me some input on that. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's a comment from Honourable Buckley, gentleman from NUMSA.
Unintended consequences. What we appreciate that government has taken this initiative so that we can hear. But when you look at unintended consequences, for us, we believe that the national minimum wage is a need in this country because of the level of poverty that we experience, that we see on daily basis. In order to uplift workers to be able to cope with the living standard in this country, there must be a minimum wage that is acceptable across sectors. And for us, we believe that the issue of whether to afford affordability is during the process we will have to discuss. How do we ensure that indeed a particular employer cannot afford? We can have sections where employers that are proven that cannot afford to apply for exemptions, for instance. But if we talk of national minimum wage, it's a need in this country. Therefore, I think we can do away with unintended consequences as we craft and deal on what the initiative that is moved.
Thank you, Mr. Vuyo. Honorable Mandasha. Colleagues, I only have one concise question to the latter speaker. And I need a concise response. In your view, did the job losses that occurred in the agricultural sector a consequence of the minimum wage that was introduced, or was it a retaliation of employers who have over time exploited those workers? Remember, so, for instance, I am a daughter of a peasant who worked on the farm, whose salary was a bag of mealie-meal and a bottle of sour milk. That's why I'm asking now, was this a retaliation of those employers who had over time accumulated profits, exploited those workers badly, or was this a real consequence of the minimum wage? And as such, I would ask you a question. What is the view of your organization on this matter? Thank you. No questions from this side? Okay. Noted, Mr. Nyagamba. The gentleman at the desk, your name, sir?
Thank you. The person, the one in the middle from the consult.
Oh, okay. So it should be yourself, and then there was another hand there. No, it will be yourself, gentlemen, at the back, and then Mr. Nyagamba, and then we take that one. In that order.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson, and so good morning to everybody here. What we, from organized labor side, also want to get as clarity from Mr. Sharp, who was speaking earlier on, is whether if they also have something that would, in their opinion, be a fair and balanced income for people who have been victims of this apartheid that brought us from way back to where he started, when he explained to us this little history of where we come from to where we are right now today. Because ever since we were in this in this assembly hall earlier on this week, we couldn't find it from the business sector to say, yes, we know that people comes a long way with this apartheid and that they've suffered, but nobody is willing to give us an idea of at least what would be a fair figure, more or less, in what area. And then also, it is been noted not only right here in this assembly, but even in South Africa, in our various workplaces, the same trend is going forward to say that you ask for the most exploited people or the most vulnerable people to at least live better and earn a national minimum income, you're looking at retrenchments. That's the first ammunition that they put within their weapons to shoot if you ask for people to live just a little bit better. So it would be really helpful to organize labor if we could have a little bit of more meat around that bone, because this report back from all this input given by Mr. Sharp is not helping any way into the house of organized labor. I can do nothing with what I've heard here today. I really would like to go and tell the workers out or the members out there, this is how business is feeling. This is what they feel. We worth 5 rand per day, or the 105 rand was too much. It should be 95. Something clear must come up, even though it was not their final position. But there must have been something on which they prepared themselves to come here and show some serious impression to this House in Parliament that we are serious in uplifting workers' lives, and that is not what we are picking up. Thank you very much, madam.
Maybe let's allow him to answer the 3 questions, and then after the questions, I'll go over to Mr. Nyagamba. Are you happy with that? Okay. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will start with the questions of the honourable members. Mr. Bagram's question is related to how certain we can be that the minimum wage is what caused the drop in employment. Now, I mentioned agriculture, but the same is true of the mining sector. 20 years ago, employment in mining was 1.4 million, and today it is just over 500,000. These are the case studies that we can go on because it illustrates one very important thing about the minimum wage. The minimum wage affects the most vulnerable people in society and the economy. I mentioned the agriculture and mining sectors, not because they are isolated examples, but because those two sectors have the least skilled people in the entire economy. So, sector after sector, the same pattern emerges. That where minimum wages were introduced, like agriculture and mining to some extent. Employment has dropped. And in those sectors where there hasn't been a minimum wage, like financial services and retail and wholesale trade, those sectors have flourished in terms of employment. So, Honourable Bagram, I would say it is categorical. Where minimum wages have been introduced in South Africa, employment has dropped. I will go to the other honourable member who asked a question, looking for a concise answer. The concise answer is that the idea of a conflict between employers and employees is a very old-fashioned idea. The successful employers in South Africa and everywhere work in conjunction with their employees. I want to ask this question, which follows from the Honourable Member's question. If a national minimum wage has unacceptable, unintended consequences, what is the alternative? How do we otherwise raise wages for people if it's not through a national minimum wage? How do we, in other words, achieve the same outcome with a different method? The only long-term way to raise wages is to raise the skills of workers earning those wages. That means improved primary and secondary education. It means more tertiary educational options. It means more on-the-job work experience. And all of the things that take a long time to implement. It's very tempting to say that a national minimum wage is a shortcut to raising wages for people. But there are no shortcuts in the economy. Skills, experience, qualifications, those are the things that raise wages in a sustainable way over the long term. I want to address quickly the two guests from organized labor, and I'm sure that what I will say now will be highly controversial.
Sorry, before I forget, before you go to that answer of the guest, just on this, I heard you that you wanted the honorable member to answer the question. You are not posing members. You can ask your questions, but we are here to listen to you, so that at the end of the day, when the whole process is done, we can then come up with a fruitful product that will be acceptable to the majority of the people. I can't say everybody, I'll say majority. But I hear you talking about the skills, what is needed to stop the unacceptable consequences of minimum wage. Instead, how to do that, how to do away with that instead of implementing it. You are talking of skills, you are talking of experience, you are talking of qualifications. Can you speak? Just talk on all these issues that we have raised to domestic workers, to farm workers, to security, to construction, all these workers that are vulnerable, who have a history. Just talk to that, talk to them, and with all what you have categorized to be the way to deal with the disparities in terms of national wage.
Thank you, Chairperson. I value the opportunity to elaborate a little bit on my answer. Why do skills, experience, and qualifications raise wages? They raise wages because employees who have those things become more valuable to employers. And an employer has the option either to pay the employee more or to lose that employee to another employer to whom that employee is valuable. The economy is in an extraordinary equilibrium, a very deep and effective equilibrium. If an employee does not feel that the wage is appropriate to his or her skills, experience, and qualifications, he can seek or she can seek alternative work. That is the discipline in the market economy, is that if employers don't pay those employees an appropriate wage for their skills and experience and qualifications, that employee will move to another employer who will. It's difficult to see this for the most vulnerable workers. But I disagree that workers are more vulnerable in particular sectors. In the security sector, private security sector, employees include supervisors, managers, etc., who are not vulnerable. In the agricultural sector, foremen and others who organize work, they have more skills. They are not vulnerable. They can easily migrate to a different sector. Who are the most vulnerable workers in any society? It's the youth. Young people, particularly under the age of 25, who have only a secondary education, those are the most vulnerable people in a society. And I would say that we need to shift perspective toward the youth. That is why youth are excluded from economic activity. It's because they have the lowest skills, the lowest on-the-job work experience, and the lowest qualifications. So to me, the question is, how do you get youth into the labour market? Again, there are no shortcuts. You've got to provide those workers, those youth job applicants, you've got to provide them with good primary and secondary education. You've got to provide them with on-the-job learning and training. And you've got to provide them with qualifications. These don't mean university or FET qualifications. The wonderful system of the CETAs, the industry bodies where workers can gain recognition for the qualifications they have developed on the job, these CETAs are very important because they allow people to accumulate qualifications while they are working. So the question that arises is, how do you employ those youth and improve their prospects in the workforce if they are the most vulnerable people? Well, you've got to open up the workforce to new opportunities, new economic opportunities, and you've also got to assist those youth. And that was one of the reasons, I think, why the National Treasury introduced the employment tax incentive, which was to subsidize the entry of youth into the labor market. Is that a sufficient answer, madam?
It is a sufficient answer. I hear that you are saying there is nothing like vulnerable workers. You can only refer to vulnerable workers when you talk to the youth that is unemployed. That's what you are saying. Can I pass? Thank you, sir.
Other
questions.
Sorry. I want to address this, and I'm sure you will chuckle when you hear me say this, because maybe you think that I'm too cynical. But I want to address the two visitors, the two guests today who spoke about organized labor. When I say that youth are the most vulnerable segment in an economy, in the labour market. And when I say that there are no shortcuts to improved wages and working conditions, one of the questions I need to answer is why does organised labour insist on a national minimum wage? Other sectors of society are normally quite, they realise there's a complex there's a complex argument that is going on around why minimum wages should or should not be introduced. But one of the questions that occurs to me is why is organised labour so definitively in favour of minimum wages? Well, as I say, you might think that I'm very cynical, but the reason for it is that trade unions are interested in protecting their members. It is a misconception that trade unions speak for everybody, including the unemployed. Trade unions speak for the interests of their members. Now, why would their members be interested in a high national minimum wage? The reason is that if the minimum wage is very high, it would exclude competition from young people trying to enter the labour market. This is exactly what happened during the 20th century. White workers belonging to trade unions tried to exclude black workers from the workforce. And they did that by raising minimum wages. The same modus operandi exists today. Economically, trade unions want to exclude competition for their members from new entrants into the labour market, and those new entrants are typically young, unqualified, inexperienced people. So when organised labour says to you, we demand a living wage, we demand a high minimum wage, what they actually are calling for in effect is to exclude competition from new entrants into the labour market. So they operate in the vested interests of their members, not of the unemployed.
Can you switch off your medicine, please? Thank you. And then the gentleman there, is that the Coleman? Yes. And then the gentleman with the, this one, the next, yes. So, Mr. Nyekemba, Mr. Coleman, and then the gentleman here. I've noted the other hands in that order.
Thank you, I'm from the office of the Ministry of Labour. The presentation, Shepherdson, started with history of the labour market, the Rand revolt, and also linked the Platinum Belt within the Rand Revolt of 1922, as it was indicated. And listening to the presentation and the responses to questions that were raised earlier, from one sitting is like an argument of trying to discourage any attempt country having a national minimum wage. But I also think that South Africa is not an island. It's part of the globe. And there are experiences internationally. There are countries where there are national minimum wages. In July this year, Germany is one example. And that national minimum wage in Germany is not something that they thought of in June, and then in July they implemented the national minimum wage. There was a dialogue in all sectors. Now, the also the presentation made comparisons of the employment before the dawn of democracy in 1994, which, according to the presentation, it made it difficult for farming industry to maintain or continue to employ more, because this government, which made it possible for all parties here, from parties and from individuals, to have a say in determining policies that has to be the outcome of government processes. Now, my question, therefore, Chairperson, is to the presenter, what do you say to the International Labour Organization study that has been conducted in relation to national minimum wage and sectoral minimum wages? What is your organizational take in relation to that? And linked to that is that comparison that was made to say, when there was subsidy, government subsidy to the farming industry before 1994, after 1994, then the number of employment in that industry has been drastically reduced. And I assume that that is because of what government did. I think that's the point that you are raising. What do you say about structural determination that was not there before 1994? What were the conditions of workers in the farming industry? I'm not saying now they are good, but my point is, what do you say? Because as a result of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act of 1997, then the Minister of Labour has to put in place structural determination in a particular industry where there's no bargaining council. So what were the conditions? Do you then say structural determinations are not supposed to be met? Is it what you say? Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you, Honorable Nyakemba. The gentleman in the second desk, yourself? Yes.
The deeper we get into the discussion of the presentation made by Mr. Sharp, I think the more we lose him on where he wants to go with his presentation. Mr. Sharp took it then upon himself to say that there is a solution for all of this. He said the only long-term solution to all this problem in which we are here for today in Parliament discussing the national minimum wage that we would like to look at is but to get people educated. And it makes me to get so worried that one can safely say, for the picking of grapes down in the vineyard, you're going to need a degree, you need an LLB to go and pick grapes. You're going to need this PhD to go and pick up all the mess there where you breed the pigs and all these things. These things does not go for me to any point of making sense. Furthermore, it is very safe for me from organized labor to say it's not that easy as how Mr. Sharp would like to make it sound here, that people can go and get skill training on the skills development and all that. We are now so far away from 1994, and here in the Western Cape, on specific farms where people employ more than 1,000 workers, there is no day that they can dream of getting any skill development training on those specific farms or in those domestic houses where they do domestic work, or even within the areas where we really know people are earning very, very low income. So that hasn't worked. It never worked. There are still a power play from employers onto employees in the 2014 year that we are within, to see that employees get more qualified or more uplifted in skills development and all that. They don't get that attention. That's the first thing. And then secondly, it is so unsafe for Mr. Sharp to make the statement that when trade unions speak, they think they speak also for the unemployed. Yes, we do. We do speak for the unemployed, because some of us, if you just take time and look at our constitutions as organized labor, we make space for the unemployed. We go out and look for work for them. We train them in our seminars. We want them to come on board. We want them to be here. What do we want this association where Mr. Sharp is coming from to do is to look into what we are really doing, and it's so far from the truth to say that all that we do not like is the oncoming youth to get into the labor market, and therefore we want to set up a minimum wage. That is so untrue. We would really want this minimum wage standard for South Africa, and also including the youth into that. As organized labor, we are clear on this, and we would like to respond. Thank you.
What's the point of order?
My point of order is that the honorable guest from organized labor described my statements as unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether he intends that as a threat on my personal security
in Parliament.
Explain yourself, sir. I don't think anybody, I'm not sure if there are people who view the unsafe as the threat to yourself, because as I'm listening, the gentleman is gone further to explain how is that safe in relation to workers. But I'll give him an opportunity to explain, because he is the person who has said that. But from where I'm seated, definitely, would I felt that what he's saying is threatening you personally, I would have stopped him.
Thank you.
So I think for yourself to be comfortable, maybe you didn't hear what he was saying when he elaborated as to what he meant by unsafe, he can repeat himself so that everybody here understands what is that meant. I don't want us to come out of this house and make statements that are not there. So please explain yourself. Elaborate, because the presenter didn't hear you when you elaborated on the question of the unsafety of workers when it relates to what you are saying.
I thank you very, very much, Madam Chairperson, and I would start off in saying that it's 100% safe for Mr. Sharp to know that there's no threats coming from organized labor. We are not threatening Mr. Sharp as an individual or the organization that he represents here today, or the document if he so submitted one. We are just saying that because we are dealing with a very, very serious topic that Parliament brought us here for, the national wage discussion, I think we need to use this word as to safeguard ourselves within how we articulate ourselves as people in this assembly as to where we want to bring this point. And if that word is making people to feel uncomfortable, there are so many others that I could use, and I would gladly use them to make progress in this house. I thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you. You know, I want to repeat what I've said to the previous workshop. We have deliberately called everybody. We are from different backgrounds. I'm talking about the organizations that we present, different political and ideological affiliations. And when we are talking to the public as parliament, we are not talking to people who are only aligned with a different, with a certain political and ideological understanding. And therefore, when we speak, we are not going to speak the same thing. If we knew that we're all going to agree on each other on what we're saying, there wouldn't be a reason for this hearing. But we must also allow or understand that because of what I've said, we are going to differ as we speak. That's why we have all this audience. We will differ with the intention of clarifying each other. We might not understand each other at the end of the day because already of what I have said. But let's allow ourselves to differ, agree to differ. And the jargon that is out there, really, I think we should all listen. If somebody says it's dangerous, you must listen carefully. What is it? Because you can't just say it's dangerous and without explaining. So I think people must carefully listen when we talk so that there is no distortion of what you are saying at the end of the day. And anybody has a right to, even if it's not the presenter, who feels that a word that has been used was not clarified and therefore I'm not comfortable. You have a right to go out and go to the press, but I would want conventional things or words that are said here that not everybody understands to be explained. I mean, when you talk of workers, really, you will talk of unsafe now and again. They are not safe in the hands of the employers because of exploitation. You have history, including in your own research as an economist, you do know that at times workers are in dangerous positions. They are unsafe. And that word, when you talk when you are in a room with trade unions, that word is going to come up in again. And at times they will refer to situations where workers have been killed, you know, or have died. You know, they die everything in mind. They are not safe. We know they are not safe in farmers. So, but we must just listen carefully and understand what a person is saying. And immediately you feel that a person is out of order, please raise your hand. But let's not be oversensitive with each other. Thank you. I have Mr. Coleman, and I have the gentleman here, and then after that I will take the honourable this side. Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Chair. Neil Coleman from the Fatu. Chair, when Parliament and Government take decisions on these matters, they are going to, we assume and we expect that they're going to be evidence-based, they're going to be based on real facts and not on ideological posturing. And I'm afraid one doesn't know really where to begin with the presentation because it is so riddled, both with ideological posturing, but also
also, unfortunately, a number of factual errors, which, and I'll point out a couple of them. And I think that tells us about where the organization is presenting this is coming from, and I'll conclude on that at the end. But let me give a very concrete example. Mr. Lone Sharp says that there was no minimum wage covering the retail and wholesale sector. Now, that's simply factually incorrect. He said it flourished because there was no minimum wage covering it. There's a sectoral determination for that sector. I've got the determination in front of me. I can give you the actual figures from this year to 2015. Secondly, Mr. Sharp doesn't seem to have read the literature on this issue. The DPRU, the UCT DPRU, which presented to yourselves, did a detailed study of the sexual determinations from 2002 to 2007. It looked at a whole range of issues. This was for the Department of Labor, to submit it to the Department of Labor in 2010. It's on the Department of Labor's website. They looked at every single sector. They looked at the employment effects, they looked at the effects on the hours that workers were working, they looked at issues like leave, etc. It was a comprehensive study. And in relation to employment, what they found was that on balance, when you looked across all the sectors where the sexual determinations had been introduced, 650,000 more jobs were created in those sectors. There was a loss of jobs in agriculture, but even if you took account of the loss of jobs in agriculture, the net creation of jobs in those sectors where sexual determinations were introduced was 650,000 jobs. I suggest Mr. Sharp and the Free Market Foundation read the study. Secondly, the Free Market Foundation is selective about where they want the state to intervene. They want the state to intervene to provide subsidies to employers to employ youth. There they like state intervention. In fact, Mr. Sharp's own organization, which is a labor broking firm, has made extensive use of the subsidies and pocketed profits from the youth wage subsidy instead of that going to the workers. That's acceptable according to him. A second example is on the farms. He tells us that when the subsidies were withdrawn to the farmers after 1994, the sector collapsed. That was a result of the liberalization of the agricultural sector. We agree with that. But the Free Market Foundation is opposed to subsidies because it believes it interferes with the operation of the market. But it was precisely the apartheid state that acted to prop up farmers, which also had an effect on employment, but they also controlled prices. Our government was persuaded by the international global institutions to liberalize. Liberalization is what the Free Market Foundation wants. So the unintended consequences that he's talking about withdrawing state intervention, had disastrous consequences in the agricultural sector. And Mr. McGrain actually asked a very important question. He asked, was it a result of the minimum wages or was it a result of other factors? And that's the point we as COSATU have been raising consistently in the public debate, and we raised in this committee on Wednesday, that you cannot make a mechanical link between the level of wages and the level of employment. Because in fact, where wages have risen the most in this country, most employment has been created, i.e. amongst the skilled and highly paid workers. That's where most employment has been created. Where wages have stagnated, in other words, at the bottom level of the wage structure, below the level of the median, that's where most jobs have been lost. So low wages have been associated with loss of jobs, and high wages have been associated with creation of jobs. So this is voodoo economics. It's voodoo economics to talk in these terms. And we've got to look at the evidence. And my colleague from the Department of Labor is quite correct. You've got to look at the International Labor Organization studies, the studies around the world, the massive creation of jobs in Latin America, which has coincided with large-scale real increases in the national minimum wages in those countries. So the Free Market Foundation must decide what it wants. Does it want intervention in the economy? Does it want the state to withdraw? Does it want any protection to workers at all? And in fact, it doesn't. The reality is, if you take away, if you strip away the veneer of respectability and concern for our people, etc., etc., what is clear in the labour market is two things. The Free Market Foundation opposes minimum wages, and secondly opposes collective bargaining. It has gone to court to oppose the extension of collective agreements, which is the only way to ensure that collective agreements which are reached are observed by employers across the industry. It has imposed the national minimum wage on an ideological basis. Let me read from what Mr. Sharp said. He said, this is publicly in an article, regardless of the national minimum wage level, it doesn't matter if you set it at 10 rand a week or 10,000 rand a week, regardless of the level, it would be catastrophic for employment and would never work in South Africa, quote, under any circumstances. In other words, it's an ideological opposition. And the ideological opposition is because they're an organization which protects employers. It's an organization that is against worker rights. And that is why it is opposed to minimum wages and collective bargaining. So again, you know, the Free Market Foundation must just say that openly. And then what we are talking about is a race to the bottom. We're talking about a return, as Honourable Mantash referred to a situation where farm workers are paid in bags of millimil and wine in the Western Cape. So, So my plea is, in conclusion, I think that the Free Market Foundation must present us not a sort of potted history of what they regard as being the history of the labour market in South Africa, but they must present a document to us in which they coherently engage with the evidence and the information so that we can interrogate the document that they're putting forward.
Thank you. Do you want to respond? Is that your time to respond? I'll give you time to respond, or is it a point of order? Not a point of order. So can I allow other people to speak? Say, you are from?
My name is Mohammed, and I'm from NUMSA.
The name is?
Mohammed Ismail, and I'm from the Union NUMSA.
Thank you.
My point is that we should view the request for a minimum wage in the context of the huge disparities which exist in South Africa, both in the form of rich and poor, and also the high differentials in terms of the high income groups and the low income groups. And I would like to ask Mr. Sharp, where do we start with addressing this? This is a small way. The minimum wage is a small way of addressing this huge inequalities, which is in fact the highest in the world. So the notion that people should have higher skills and education in order to earn more, yes, that applies in certain aspects, but it doesn't apply to those workers who are vulnerable, those workers who are not unionized. And Mr. Sharp wants to create the notion that the unions are only there to look at their own members and so on. We have minimum wages in our sectors achieved through collective bargaining that is much higher than the national minimum wage that we're talking about, so that we can achieve the collective bargaining. When we think about the national minimum wage, we think of those vulnerable workers who are unorganized, who are working in sectors where they are extremely exploited. Those same workers pay the same for goods and services that the directors of companies who earn millions of rands per month and per year, they have to pay the same for goods and services. And we know the situation in South Africa. We're sitting on a time bomb. So if Mr. Sharp and the Free Economic Foundation don't want to see a repetition of 1922, then we should introduce and we should then promote the introduction of a minimum wage. Because if people can't put food on the table, we've seen the amount of protests we have in this country. Because people can't put food on the table. That is why people are revolting. That is why the 1922 workers revolted. So how do you expect those vulnerable workers earning a pittance, earning low wages, to improve their skills, to send their children for better and higher education as he promotes in order to earn more? It's a contradiction. We cannot say that people who don't have certain levels of education cannot have decent work and cannot earn decent wages. That is a major contradiction, and it flies in the face of achieving the type of democracy we're speaking about, and the fact that he says and confirms that there is huge economic disparities in this country. So I basically want to make those points and say that if we do not address, and we're speaking about the vulnerable workers here, like Mr. Coleman has said, the Latin American companies, and I will conclude on this point, have shown, and the figures reflect, that in fact employment increase. And why would employment increase? If people earn decent wages, they are able to consume more. They are able to purchase and buy goods more. And as they do that, it stimulates the economy, because then you have to produce more. And in producing more, you can employ more. And I think that is the effect of the Latin American scenario, where jobs actually went up. So I would argue that it will create the converse, as opposed to his argument that in fact it will share jobs. I'll conclude on that point.
Thank you, Mr. Mohammed. I think let's give him an opportunity to answer, and then I will call on other hands. Can you take this? I think that's three.
Four.
Four, yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I think there's a misconception about what the Free Market Foundation supports. We support political and economic freedom, but we don't do that as an end in itself. We do that as a means to an end. So we agree with this chamber, with this committee, that good wages, stable employment, excellent working conditions in a safe environment where people enjoy their work and have many opportunities for advancement. We agree that that is the appropriate objective of economic policies. We have no disagreement with anyone about what the goal is of these measures that are being considered at the moment. What we disagree with is that a national minimum wage is the most appropriate vehicle to bring about that objective. The history of the world since at least the 16th century shows unequivocally that economic freedom brings about those objectives. I only need to show you on a map the difference between North and South Korea under two very different and extremely different economic policies. If you take a photograph from a US Air Force weather satellite at night, and you look at South Korea, and you look at North Korea, South Korea is ablaze with lights, and North Korea has no light at all. These two countries were established at exactly the same time, with different economic circumstances, different economic institutions and economic systems. And there is no question that South Korea emerged as an economic powerhouse over exactly the same time period that North Korea collapsed economically. I know this is a very extreme example, but the question is, what produces economic prosperity? We at the Free Market Foundation believe that economic prosperity is a right of all South Africans. The question is, how do you achieve it? And our experience, which is a strong intellectual tradition all around the world, is that liberal economic systems with high amounts of economic freedom are the most beneficial arrangements to achieve economic prosperity. I think it would be misleading if we didn't suggest to this committee
that in your difficult work over the next year or 2 years, considering the national minimum wage, that there is a strong possibility that a national minimum wage will be counterproductive. And I'll just give you an example. If we look at inequality in South Africa, 85% of that story about inequality is the fact that 8.3 million people don't have work. 8.3 million people do not have a regular source of income, and as a result, South Africa has one of the highest rates of income inequality in the world, according to some of the highest. In other words, it's not an accident that South Africa has one of the highest rates of income inequality, and at the same time we have one of the highest rates of unemployment in the world. Those two things are not accidental. The most pressing way in which South Africa can reduce income inequality is to absorb people into the workforce. So we are in favor of policies that will introduce people into the world of work, support their careers, support their families. That is a clear objective of economic policy for us at the Free Market Foundation. We just believe that the national minimum wage, by increasing unemployment, will increase inequality, will increase poverty. And I think it would be unfair if we couldn't point out that possibility, that very strong possibility that a national minimum wage will add to rather than reduce income inequality.
Are you done, sir?
I just want to say that Mr. Coleman is talking about my previous employment, which was at AdCorp as labor economist. I have since moved to the Free Market Foundation as economist. So Mr. Coleman is working on outdated facts, and I hope he takes notice of that.
Thank you, sir. Honorable Prati Samakhang.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to first ask if Mr. Shark allows us to request some clarity in terms of the book. Because when you go to page 62 of Job, but I hope the author will please add jobs, and living wage. This book in page 62, it says setting minimum wages is considered by labor unions and their supporters to be an essential element of jobs that they call decent. A dictionary definition of decent is seemingly not immodest or obscene or indelicate. The choice of such a wage to describe a regulatory mechanism that is guaranteed to make low-skilled or otherwise vulnerable potential workers unemployable is diabolical to the point of being obscene, and the regulation decidedly is indecent and cruel. I just want to understand, you spoke about the centuries from 16 centuries. I will check the title of the book I read of discussion between masters about their slaves, where masters were saying, I buy clothes for my slaves, I feed them, I teach them how to smile and how to sleep. Your presentation, I want you to address me, to address us, how does it how do you address the apartheid structure of cheap labor and the way, because I can see that what you are talking about, one or the other deregulation, which means we should trust that the employers will do good. And then since 1994, I think you can see that the uprising that we are having into working places because workers are not happy. So my view of minimum wage is to address the inequalities of the past, because the minimum wage is not about giving just workers a salary. It's about making sure that we address the inequalities of the past. And then in your presentation, you are not addressing the inequalities of the past. And we hope that, I just want to use one example which Mr. Coleman wrote. He gave an example of Henry Ford. I'm sure he knows what I'm talking about. Where he said, Henry Ford, he realized that his workers cannot afford to buy his cars. Then he raised salaries to living wage. Then immediately the sales of his cars went very, very high. And the words used in the book, that the minimum wage, it simply says it is cruel. And the way you are talking, you look like you understand history. And then if you understand history, the comparison of Marikana and the Rand Rebellion, you missed one thing. Those white mine workers were fighting for a decent wage. The pillar of their strike, it was not political, it was a decent living wage. For them to choose the Nationalist Party, it was the ultimate response of having a favorable government that would listen to their concerns. So now, I think the key issue is to have a society that caters for all. If you have a society that caters only for employment, and actually perpetuate what has been happening even before democracy, I think that is very unsustainable. And I don't see how we are going to avoid civil unrest with that presentation. It is, actually, I can't see it. I can't make sense of how South Africa will be in 20 years when you still have cheap labor. And, you know, to say, I want you to just help me also. When you say education will help, I will give you examples of how employers can actually, if we don't have a developmental state where government assists with minimum wage, employers have a way of excuses, even if people are educated. They will still, if we don't at least a bit intervene through minimum wage, you'll still have people with degrees unemployed. So I want to say, clarify, please. And then in your presentation and also in this book, I don't see any appreciation of the role of unions. This one I'm just saying so that you can help me. But I hope you will help us, because if you can help us, I think I'll understand the balance of the way you are actually spearheading the protection of employment of employers. But I want you also to look into making sure that you spend much time in also making sure that you know that these are historical imbalances. And then the intent is to make sure that our country move forward, catering the needs of workers. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll meet the lady there, and then after that it will be Honorable Lolu.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. To Mr. Sharp, thank you for the presentation that you did. And it started from the history, takes us through apartheid, taken us through the last 20 years that we've been in democracy in South Africa, and how it impacts on the labor movement itself. Now, what we would like to understand is the road to minimum wage has already begun. We have sectoral determinations that are setting minimum standards. We have main collective agreements that are setting minimum standards across various sectors. We have a lot that the government has already done so far. We understand that through change there's always resistance. People, they always come up with ways and means of putting information or giving out information that must make the other party feel vulnerable enough to understand that whatever good that they are supposed to be receiving is not good for them. But as labor, you even made mention of a private security. I'm from Satao, actually. You made mention of supervisors and managers that are not vulnerable. I wish you can take me to a company that we organizing at Satao that has a supervisor that is not vulnerable, that is earning 3,000 rand. With the amount of work that they do, with all that they do, with powers that are much more than what they are expected to do, that your employers that you are protecting here today seem to be imposing on those supervisors that are also our members. And the fear of the employers when we are talking of a minimum wage, I think they should just lay that to rest, because as labor, we cannot sit and say our children, when they come to employment, they must come and earn the very same peanuts that we are earning now. Minimum wage, you are talking of setting up standards. We have a 54-year-old security guard that is earning 2,500. In a couple of years, that security guard is going to go to pension, meaning the very same youth that you are told as unions that we do not care about in terms of their well-being are going to come and join the very same 2,500 if we do not correct it as we speak. So the notion of trade unions only caring for their members and not thinking about the unemployed youth that is out there, I think that's what we should be getting out of everyone's mind in this house today. Because the main collective agreements that we negotiate, the sectoral determinations that are set there, that is the work of the government in conjunction with the trade unions, and it is setting up minimum standards, and it is elevating the very same youth that is going to come to come and gain employment. So you even spoke of qualifications and skills and centers. Tell me of an employer in a private security company that has ever taken their employees through skills development. You will think and you will never even come up, not even one. Surely they do submit, but where are they getting those steps from? That is our daily fight with employers. And we cannot be sitting here today and agreeing with the fact that whatever the apartheid system brought to South Africa, we must remain with it because we do not have a way. We cannot be sitting here representing so many people that are out there, so many people that have got hope and faith in South Africa that has changed for so much. So many people that are out there that are telling themselves that one day they are going to be earning as much as the employers do. They will be owning businesses as much as the employers do, that there is no hope for them at all. We haven't received your book, but I'm sure the Comrade Bumakhang, you even promised that you are going to get that book. So even though I do not think it's going to make much of a difference in terms of what we want for our members and for our people. You mentioned that minimum wage will increase poverty. How is it that when you go to Pick and Pay and pick the best and the nutritious food and the healthy food from the racks, that will increase poverty? How is it that when you are able to afford the exits that the employers drive, that you are increasing poverty? If you can at least explain that one line for me that you said that if we get the minimum wage, we'll be increasing poverty. How is it that I can afford to go and stay in such a group increasing poverty? Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Pamela from the town.
Okay, thanks. How many? It's two. Okay, let me take Honorable Lodiwe, and then I'll take another hand, and we'll give the gentleman an opportunity to respond. Maybe two after Lodiwe.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also appreciate this oral presentation. As a word of advice, when you are invited in Parliament, because we have a responsibility to shape the law of the country, it's advisable that you make a written presentation. That is to ask an indication that you value the invitation and respect the people that have invited you. Secondly, I don't think we are taking comfort in your insinuating that new members can be assisted by this book. When we extended an invitation, nobody said you are invited by new members. You are invited by a committee. And here there's a flow of information. So never undermine members to say they are new in Parliament, so they may not know what you are going to present all of you. In your presentation, you came up sharply more of an employer representative than an all-rounder. What I want you to come out clear in talking to us is to say, in your institution, do you have a position on the minimum wage? Because the greater part of your presentation was on the evolution of labor in South Africa, which was not necessarily what we wanted to hear. Here we want to compare inputs on the minimum wage so that we can guide the state in making law on the minimum wage issue. So that's the guidance that we want. And then I've already indicated that your input was more on the employer perspective. If you are comparing the unfortunate Marikana issue with the rent revolt, what then do you think is supposed to be done here when we discuss minimum wage? Because we don't want a second rent revolt. I don't agree with you that it was a second display of the rent revolt, but everybody is free to his or her opinion. The last question I want to ask you, can you unpack what you mean when you say trade unions bar especially black people from getting work? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Lodiwe. Noted the gentleman over there.
Okay, thank you, Comrade Chair. The name is Pascal, the surname is Musi, and I'm the chairperson for Kayala Kunya Human Development. Kayala Kunya is the governing body for 11 lines of businesses, and we operate from Guguletu. I'm also a member of the District 6 Reference Group, which advises Mr. Gugule Quinty, the Premier Helen Ziller, and the Mayor Patricia Delo on issues affecting District 6. Thank you so much. Let me start with one quote before getting into my actual story. Open quote. The world of employment is changing and social employers pay their employees a minimum wage. Increasing numbers of employees want a living wage than just an understanding of the concepts of skills. Yes, they also want a life of happiness for themselves and their families. It is also not enough for employers to constantly harp about the minimum wage being harmful or it impacting negatively on employment, close quote. Based on my experience as a political activist and a guerrilla journalist, the next uprising in this country will make all others look like a Sunday picnic. You will beg employers with dignity to assist the government to develop their employees by paying them a minimum wage minimum wage so not to die in poverty. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Jeremy Murray, a member of the Cape Town Chamber of Commerce. I think a couple of issues.
Sorry, come again, the name?
Jeremy Murray, from the Cape Chamber of Commerce. A couple of issues with Mr. Sharp's presentation. I think the first thing is the issue was mentioned that the national minimum wage acts almost like a semi-barrier to entry. You know, into the for people getting access into the labour market. I'm yet to see that in the literature. So, you know, I don't know whether there's a verified basis for that type of insight or analysis, because the labour absorptive capacity of an economy, there's many factors that impact on that. So you cannot have a causal link purely in terms of that aspect which you mentioned. The second issue is, isn't there a broader social net gain for workers of having a national minimum wage? And then my last issue, Chair, is the issue of given the current economic growth trajectory, various sectors are in different, have different productivity trends, different stages of call it the business cycle, etc. What in your opinion is the, if we had to have a cost-benefit analysis of a national minimum wage, assuming the targeted amount was set, what would be the outcome? Thank you.
Over to you, Mr. Thank you, Jeremy. Over to you, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I'd like to go in reverse order in my responses, please. The first point I'd like to make is there are two groups of people who benefit from a national minimum wage. The first group I've already described, which is organized labor. And let me just give a one-sentence indication of how organized labor benefits from a national minimum wage. If you push up or introduce a national minimum wage, that excludes new entrants with limited experience and limited skills from joining the workforce. I've already touched on that, but that's the one-line summary. The second group of people who benefit from a national minimum wage is large businesses. Large businesses are represented overly in business organizations and industry bodies. But large businesses, JSE-listed businesses, only represent 9% of the national workforce. 65% of total employment happens in companies employing less than 50 people. Now, why do large businesses, they may not advocate the national minimum wage, but I bet you won't get many presentations from large enterprises. And maybe when Booster comes to talk to you, if they will, they will probably be equivocal about the minimum wage. In the same way that organized labor uses the national minimum wage to drive out competition from entry-level workers, large businesses use high minimum wages to drive out competition from small business enterprises. These are the two groups of people who benefit most from a national minimum wage. Small businesses are overwhelmingly adversely impacted by a minimum wage. I hope that in my saying this, I can put to rest the criticisms in this committee from guests and honourable members that I represent the interests of businesses. That's not correct. I certainly don't represent the interests of big businesses. The reality of the situation is that small businesses are unduly impacted by a national minimum wage. So as I say, I'm not here as a representative of business. I also want to address the honourable member's complaint that I didn't produce a written presentation. I will certainly take that on board, and in future I will present in written form. The reason I didn't do that today is because I thought our position at the Free Market Foundation could be very easily stated, and in a book of less than 20 chapters, of 3 or 4 pages per chapter, I thought it would be very easy for the committee to refer to individual issues in the labour market in general. You will find that the Free Market Foundation's perspective is very refreshing. It's maybe not something you will agree with, but it will be an interesting test of your own views. If I can give you a piece of advice, what do you do practically with the Free Market Foundation's information today? The talk I've given, the responses I've given, the book I've handed out to members, what do you do physically? What advice would I give you? I think my advice would be very straightforward. When you get a proposal from NEDLAC, because the national minimum wage will go through the NEDLAC process, and I don't know, it probably will be held up there because NEDLAC is not entirely effective. When you receive NEDLAC input and you are asked to consider a draft bill on the national minimum wage, I would recommend to you that you ask for a regulatory impact assessment. That's all. In other words, that you get the latest thinking, technically, economically, on what will be the impacts for South Africa, not countries elsewhere in the world, for South Africa with our unique history, what will be the impact? I think the best advice I could give you, if you're open to advice, is that you ask for a regulatory impact assessment. And then if I go to the Honourable Member from Akhang, I want to state categorically that racial discrimination, not only in the workplace, but in every facet of life, is a grave, grave error. Not only in South African history, but in history around the world. At the Free Market Foundation, we do not believe that one person should be inferior to another, or that one person should be enslaved to another. That is not the free market principle. The free market principle is that people engage voluntarily with each other. And we are absolutely categorically opposed to racial discrimination, the idea of ownership implied in slavery. It's completely not aligned with our principles as a free market advocacy group that believes in voluntary relationships between people. Thank you.
Just for clarity for myself and the staff, you are saying when we get the NEDLAC report, we must look for a regulatory impact assessment on it. Just explain to me just what do you mean by that? What is that we should do?
It's very useful when you are reviewing a piece of legislation.
For you to understand what I want you to do for me, just unpack that statement.
Okay.
Exactly what is that you're saying?
Okay. So it's possible for this committee, in reviewing the legislation, to ask for a regulatory impact assessment. And the idea there is that a group of academics and experts and economists and sociologists and really a whole group of experts on the issue, that they can produce a report which gives you input as a committee on what the impact will be economically, socially, and in other ways of the bill that is eventually presented to you. And I would recommend that you do that. It will cost you nothing. It may add 3 or 4 weeks of time to your deliberations, but I think it would be very useful for you to receive expert advice, probably from a university, probably in South Africa, but possibly also abroad, on what the regulations around minimum wages will do to employment and a range of other things. I think it would be a very practical and useful tip to get that impact assessment when you do finally consider a bill or a draft bill.
And just one more question. Is there, how many bills that when you look at them, where you felt that we missed the road that you are talking about?
I'm not aware of any. I think this committee has been excellent in asking for regulatory impact assessments. But sometimes the impact assessments have come from Cabinet, and sometimes they've come from the President. So in the last 2 years, I think on a couple of occasions, the President has requested a regulatory impact assessment. But I think it's too late when the bill gets put on the President's desk. I think the deliberations really are a power and privilege of Parliament. And I think that if you have a regulatory impact assessment, it will assist your work in committee around the minimum wage regulations. So there are only a couple of instances that I know of where the regulatory impact assessment was asked for by the President before he signed the bill. But not often. I think the committee makes effective use of regulatory impact assessments already.
Thank you so much, Chef. I just want to you to rest assured. You want to say something before I go? Okay. You want to respond to that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Did you want to respond on this segment? Okay, please.
No, thank you, Chairperson. With regards to the regulatory assessments that you referred to, I think there is no legislation or amendment from this committee in the Department of Labor, a bill that has been presented to the President, and then the assessment is done later. It has never happened. With the number of amendments that has been signed off by the President, there was a regulatory assessment even before the engagement in parliamentary processes. I'm raising this question because it's very dangerous to make an example of what happened next door. If you are here, you better make an example of what happened where you are at that particular time. So I didn't want that all the guests who are here must then think that the regulatory impact assessments that were done in the current labor amendment, the impact assessment was done later. That has never happened.
I think he better say that in the committees where that has happened. I wanted to correct that in order that members and guests here, when they leave here, they must know it has never happened here. And I think listen to that, while the committee is having this workshop, you indicated that this is important. I must repeat it from the ministry's point of view, that there are two processes that are taking place. There's this process that is spearheaded by the committee. There's another process which is led by the deputy president according to the state of the national address of the president of the country. That the deputy president must bring together all social partners at net length investigating the minimum wage. So I think it is not correct for the gentleman to jump the horse. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You also want to comment on the
The Employment Tax Incentive Bill, as far as I'm aware, did not have a regulatory impact assessment anywhere in the process. I'm not talking about a regulatory impact assessment conducted by the sponsor of the bill. I'm talking about an independent regulatory impact assessment that has the sole purpose of advising this committee. It is well within this committee's power to receive such an impact assessment. But I don't think it's correct to regard the sponsor of the bill as being capable of providing independent advice about the regulatory impact of the bill. Because then you're asking the sponsor of the bill to be both judge, jury, and executioner. This committee has extensive powers to order an independent regulatory impact assessment to assist in its deliberations. Thank you.
Okay. Just, I think I must cut, did not open this discussion wider. You know, I wanted the clarity, but there's something that I wanted to get from you, from myself. You must be... I think everybody, I will ask everybody that you must have confidence in these committees of parliament. I know there are lots of perceptions out there that maybe think that members of parliament are not capable of coming out with the products. And in most cases, these bills are questioned. This one, we know, it's going to be questioned at the end of the day. When you come up with a project, it will be questioned. But you know that you will be questioned that. It will be the same people for the same reasons. So the process that we are in is the correct process. And we know exactly what we are doing. And the process that is done in NEDLAC, as you have correctly said, is going to be scrutinized in the same manner that your presentation that you are giving us here scrutinized. So equally, all of them, the bug stops here. And we can never take out or go out with a product that we have not checked. We'll do our checks and balances. Whether we call economists or whether we call whoever we call at the end of the day or ourselves, but we will definitely come up with the right product that is well processed. And we don't expect that product to be accepted by various quarters because we are dealing here with a sensitive and contentious issue. We are dealing with lives of people. And we don't understand, some of us don't understand, or some of us deliberately do not want to understand what is that we are addressing.
You spoke of political freedom and no economic freedom. I think the ruling, the government of the day, which is under the ANC leadership, ANC government, is fully much aware of that. That's why we are sensitive to workers. We are sensitive to people who have not yet tested. They know that there are sectors of our economy, I mean of our country, who know that there is political freedom, but there's nothing they don't know about economy. And we talk about the workers that are employed by labor brokers. We talk about workers, most of them who are in farms, who are in security industries, construction workers, domestic workers, because our definition of vulnerable workers is definitely different. I think as they were talking, members of trade union and members, they've tried. We are definitely coming from different schools when we talk of vulnerability. That's not time for that. They will deliberate on it. And as a result of that, we may not be able to get to something that we'll agree upon. But we are free, people are free. We want to hear those who are saying they're right. They must say it's not going to work or it cannot work because of the reasons that we want to hear and listen to those reasons, because we'll take them into consideration. Not necessarily that we're saying what is said here, we will go that way. We still have a long way to go. So we will listen, what are the people saying? We'll take the experience of other countries and apply it in South African conditions. So I think that's where you are. But please, don't look at this committee and judge it by its cover. You must look at the content. And the sooner you will see, very soon you will see the content of the committee as we go forward. I will not allow this dialogue. I think I've done it, and I'm creating a serious precedent that whenever there's something that someone says that one does not agree with, I must go there. So I think I want to pass for other questions. I had the gentleman here is from?
I'm from Namibia.
And then there is the gentleman there. I know you were here on Wednesday, but what organization is?
The National Union of Public Service and Allied.
Oh, okay, so it will be you, and then it will be COSA today. In that order, yourself, gentleman from NUMSA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I must thank you for the opportunity granted to speak. Well, maybe I should just start where Mr. Sharp stopped with regards to trade unions fearing the competition between the new entrants within the labor market and the older workers of the older generation. And I must use the word dangerous. As a shop steward, it is dangerous for me to sit here and absorb a total misrepresentation from a person who does not represent me. It is dangerous. We as organized labor on the 19th of March, we took it to the streets, doing exactly what is distorting, fighting against what is in favor of, which is the youth subsidy, which we thought it was going to put those young workers in dire situation. And we've done many presentations in the public domain, including Parliament, in our opposing of the youth subsidy. Because in our view, that youth subsidy would have brought a situation where in industry these young people would find themselves working in a situation where they work next to a worker who earns 3,000 more what would have been earning. And that's what the youth subsidy was advocating for. And we are opposing that. So it cannot be correct that workers doing the same work, they have different income salary. That's what we're saying. So it is dangerous, Mr. Sharp, to come here and do misrepresentation of other organization in which you're not working for. Furthermore, Madam Chair, I come from a upbringing where we believe that the Freedom Charter is a cornerstone in dealing precisely with the political emancipation, with the economical liberation of our people. That's the school of thought that I'm coming from. And among the things that the Freedom Charter advocates for is that men and women of all races shall receive equal pay for equal work, which exactly the gentleman, what he has presented here, tells us that we must accept those anomalies. And we cannot do that, unfortunately. And I want to cite two examples why we can't accept that. And I'm quoting from a community survey which was done in 2007, which Mr. Sharp, I'm sure, is in good position of that survey. White people earn an average of 4 times what Africans earn. Half of African workers earn less than 2,383. That is the survey that was done. And the survey continues, it says, general whites earn 8 times what Africans earn. Where is it estimated that an African male earns an average of 2,400 rand, while his white counterpart earns 19,000 rand. And I'm carefully citing these because we have a historical, a background to these appalling realities that were studied in 2007, which are still in existence, of the apartheid capitalist regime that created these situational problems that we are facing. And our call for minimum wage in or across the sector, it is informed by these statistics, which all the economists of this country are in position of. So, as I'm concluding, I want to re-emphasize the point that was raised by the honorable member, of course, who raised an issue of persons come in this sitting without a written presentation. Well, that's the problem that we're finding ourselves in now, that Mr. Sharp continues to refer us to bills and bills and bills that he is not really informed about as a result of coming here unprepared to argue for or against the minimum living. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. A lot of my points that I wanted to respond on has been covered by other speakers earlier, but I want to remind us that, and in particular our honourable guest, Mr. Sharp, that the best place for us to really be educated is Zapa M. Sabalanswe, is in the place of struggle. As workers, we come through those struggles
some of us, we are still there, and we are still continuing to strive to advance the interests of the poorest of the poor. Now, I want to go back, if I didn't miss something perhaps, or perhaps I'm not sure if I'm taking leave of my senses now, but I want to agree with Mr. Sharp when he said that the national minimum wage is not, and I take his words, is not the most appropriate vehicle to address the social inequalities that is so prevalent within our society. Correctly so, it is correct to say that, because that is what we are saying is labor. It is not the only, but certainly a very small progressive step in the right direction. Because this thing should not be seen in isolation of having a national minimum wage with other measures to address the vast social inequalities within our society. For example, looking at aspects like the wage subsidy for youth, looking at tightening up the market policies to clamp down on people who want to flood our markets with cheap labor imports, that are goods that are imported from other countries where workers are being also subjected to exploitative measures by the profit-making system. Yes, there should be those measures, and I want to say, I'm not sure, maybe by the end of the day, or perhaps there should be more of these vigorous engagements, so that I think people who are having such neoliberal kind of, and I'm not out to, this is perhaps an unintended consequence, I'm not out to attack a pulverized speaker, but I think certainly we need more such kinds of engagement that people can be educated about really what is that we are heading for and what we are intending for. Because I certainly agree with the last speaker from NUMSA that this is a gross misrepresentation on the part of the honorable speaker, in particular articulating the position of labor. Because that is not what labor is arguing, that a simplistic or mechanical view to addressing these inequalities within our society. So yes, certainly, Madam Speaker, through you, I think we need more of this engagement so that we can sensitize people who are coming from the other opposite part of this equation, in particular that of business. Needless to say that it's a pity that the gentleman was not here for the other session, to have been exposed to some form of sensitization in terms of the shifts that are taking place within the business community. And here I want to refer to the Black Management Forum, who in a sense, although they have articulated and have tried to do some balancing act, they have by and large have moved in the right direction, I would suggest. So perhaps it's an appeal that the gentleman, honourable gentleman, need to apply himself really more thoroughly to the reality that we are faced with in this country, and not just to merely try and put forward ideological perspectives that are becoming more and more distorted in representing the position of the poor. Madam Chairperson, with those few comments, I just want to say I trust that the gentleman takes it in the spirit that I've suggested.
Thank you,
Professor. Yeah, thanks, Chair. You know, in my introduction to my first remarks, I made the point that we need evidence-based analysis. We need to look at the facts on the table. So when we use terms like regulatory impact assessment, it likes to sound very technical and neutral. We'll have people assessing. But we mustn't rig the questions beforehand. We mustn't create the impression in people's minds that the only question is how many jobs are going to be lost. The question may be how many jobs are going to be created. The question may be how is this going to address poverty and inequality. But the reality also is that these are not technical questions that you can predict. We're not crystal ball gazers. There has to be a coherent package which the government is trying to put together to combine the national minimum wage, as my colleague said, with other measures that are going to address the issues. No one is claiming that the national minimum wage is a panacea. The second misconception, which I think keeps on being repeated, and it was raised in the last session as well, is the notion that minimum wages are in some way bad for small business. And I'm sure we'll deal with this after Niyata has spoken. But if you look at the international experience again, the situation is that in relation to small business, and it's true in this country as well, small businesses are affected the least of any businesses by minimum wages. And the reason for that is that the very low compliance rate by businesses in this country is worse amongst small businesses because there's very limited capacity to implement and enforce. But more importantly, actually, if you look at surveys of small businesses, the issue of wages isn't their primary issue. The issue of wages is access to affordable finance, is access to support from the state. And if you look at what they did in Brazil, they formalized the small businesses. They brought them into the tax net. They brought them into the labor market net after 2003 at much higher minimum wage levels. And there was a massive creation of jobs in that small business sector. What was the single biggest reason for that? The single biggest reason was the massive credit, which was extended at a competitive rate by the Development Bank of Brazil to small businesses. So again, let's not be selective and narrow in the type of facts which we try to create. And for big businesses, the minimum wage isn't the wage that affects most businesses. The national minimum wage is the absolute floor, the lowest that anybody should be paying. Collective bargaining sets wages consistently higher than the issue of the national minimum wage. So that's all the national minimum wage is. It's a floor, and we've got to look at the transformation of the entire wage structure, and that's what they've done in countries like Brazil, even the UK. The Economist pointed out that what they've seen in the UK is a compression of the wage structure. As the national minimum wage rises, you also see the reduction of inequality at other levels of the wage structure. But we'll try and go into that in more detail when we have an opportunity to present. The third misconception that is constantly being repeated is that the issue isn't the inequality between workers and those who are being high paid, or CEOs of the lowest paid, or even different levels of the wage structure, or different industries. It's actually between the unemployed and the employed. But Mr. Sharp and others conveniently forget to point out that the unemployed and the employed live in the same household. So the issue is that the employed are supporting the unemployed, not only in their households, but in the extended families, which is what we saw in Marikana, where people were talking about supporting 12 to 15 unemployed relatives. So we've got to look at the inequality between households, not between individuals, between households. And the fact is that African households, in particular, are mainly below the poverty line, and the real stagnation of the wages being paid to the lower income groups, in other words, the median wage, has actually stagnated over time, and the facts are there. Not from us, but from other business institutions, actually, has led to problems and pressures that those households are facing. And then finally, the last couple of points is Mr. Sharp, again, must be educated about unions' positions on the national minimum wage. That has been a fierce debate both in South Africa and internationally. There are a lot of unions that have not been comfortable with the notion of a national minimum wage. And the reason why they haven't been comfortable is that they feel that they don't want the state to come in and intervene on workers' behalf because it may decrease the organizational mobilization of unions. They'd rather have a situation like you had in Germany, Scandinavia, etc., where you have extensive collective bargaining between employers and unions and where they negotiate based on conditions in those sectors. The problem with that, and why Germany has now introduced a national minimum wage, is because employers use all methods through deregulation, labor broking, contracting out, etc., to create this enclave of vulnerable workers. And what they found in Germany was that there was massive poverty beginning to emerge amongst the working poor. and therefore they had to introduce the national minimum wage, not to protect union members against other workers. Those workers were also union members, but to deal with super exploitation. So Mr. Sharp, again, we can give him the literature if he's interested in seeing that. And then finally, a couple of colleagues have spoken about this constant emphasis of, well, you've got to get skills, you've got to get educated. As Mr. Sharp acknowledged, this government has introduced a system which tries to recognize not just formal education, but prior learning and skills and experience. The reality is the employers refuse to embrace that. And as a couple of my colleagues from the labor movement, from Satawa and Nomsa and others have outlined, what has happened is that workers who are having that experience, prior learning, skills, et cetera, even if it's not certified, are remaining at a very low level. And what you find is that workers who are entering as new entrants to the labor market, and those who are much more experienced, are earning very similar amounts of money. And this is why actually the right-wing economists use this, and unfortunately Treasury fell into the same trap, to try and argue that our entry-level wages are very high in relation to more experienced workers. The entry-level wages are very, very low, actually, but the proportion between entry-level wages and experienced workers is very limited because of this fact that experience is not being rewarded. So that is a trap which low-paid workers are finding themselves in. And to talk about some education pie in the sky that's going to come at some future date, John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. So, you know, workers need these issues addressed now and in the short to medium term.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Shah.
You know, Mr. Coleman is incoherent. He calls for evidence-based reasoning, but then he gives us a string of anecdotes, including a casual newspaper. I think we can dismiss what he has to say completely. It doesn't form part of a broader sense-making process of what is occurring. That's my comment.
No further hands. Let's take 5 minutes comfort break, and then we are going to be listening to National Employers Association of South Africa. Thank you.